Welcome to Two-Way Street. I'm Bill Nygut. Okay, so now you know that Christian Bush was part of a big news story in the world of country music last week. He and his former Sugarland musical partner, Jennifer Nettles, are back together, and they've made their first record since they went their separate ways 5 years ago. When they parted company, Sugarland was one of the biggest acts in country music. She left to have a baby and to make movies. He began furiously turning out song after song as he began his career as a solo artist. During his past appearances on Two-Way Street, Christian has talked about his solo career, about his life on the road, and played us his latest Christmas songs. But of course, I always asked him the question that millions of fans wanted to hear an answer to. When is Sugarland getting back together? And now we know the answer. Later in today's show, we'll talk about that long-awaited reunion. But since this is a holiday show, let's start with Christian's passion for Christmas music. You know, Christian Bush, this has become kind of an annual tradition for Two-Way Street. You come in before Christmas and, among other things, play us some of your Christmas music and keep us updated on your life. And this has been a big year for you in many ways.
Yeah, this year is it feels to me, you know, like sometimes when you're low on cash, you pick up like a UPS delivery job just for the winter, you know, because, you know, they have packages they got to deliver and you need the little extra money. Right. and they're that kind of company. Or sometimes when I was a kid, I used to stock shelves during the holidays because, you know, a lot of people in grocery stores, who if they work there a long time, they don't necessarily want that shift.
Yeah.
And I feel like I picked up a second job and now that became permanent.
You mean writing Christmas songs?
Yeah, well, yeah. And now I have all my jobs on top of each other. So I feel like I'm one of those people that maybe needs to go to a seminar to learn how to say no a little more emphatically. But yes, I've had an exciting year.
The thing about you is, and we're going to talk about the year you've had, but the thing about you is, when it comes to music, my understanding of you is you always say yes, because music is the center of who you are.
Absolutely. And awkwardly, I think it's been the most unlikely job ever. And I still feel amazed to even get offered to do it again. So I'm going to say yes, because my fear is that if you say no, then you're not going to get asked again, you know?
Yeah. You grew up not right in Knoxville, right? Outside of Knoxville?
I grew up in the mountains outside of Knoxville. So the beginning of the Appalachian Mountains.
What was the name of the town?
It's called Sevierville.
That's the name of it.
And actually, my family's from a small town, weirdly, outside of the small town called Chestnut Hill, which is literally a three-way stop.
So what was Christmas like for you as a little boy growing up in Sevierville?
Well, you gotta squint your eyes a certain way. Are you familiar with Branson, Missouri?
Sure.
So Sevierville,
where all the stars now have
right.
Their
so that was
big
kind of
music
an,
palaces.
It's kind of an outpost for the retirement of country music as a destination for people in Middle America that wanted to go on vacation and didn't have a whole bunch of money. Well, Sevierville is right next to a place called Pigeon Forge, which has Dollywood
Dolly
in it.
Parton.
And it was the 4 square miles on your way into the Appalachian Mountains to get into Gatlinburg. And it became something that a lot of people maybe do during the fall. You know, there was always a lot of cars that would come into this tiny little town, and you'd be like, where's this traffic? And it was people coming to see the leaves, right? And that was in the early 70s when I was just a small young human. And as I grew up, they found out how to kind of keep more of that tourist money. So they put in like water parks and go-kart things and wax museums. And it was just it was like slipping on the banana peel of tourism. Suddenly there are like the Barbara Mandrell like sisters had theaters there. And suddenly you had like 2 miles of what looked like Branson, Missouri. Right. So Christmas for me was all those businesses putting up elaborate light shows that were somehow timed to the radio. And this is 70s, early 80s, which was way ahead of the curve of most of Middle America finding out how to do this. So, you know, there were people that usually fixed trucks that were welding together large structures in order to wrap lights around them. So I grew up in that.
You've just, though, I have to say, burst a bubble for me.
Oh, no.
When I thought about your growing up in the mountains of Tennessee, I thought Christian Bush probably had one of those great country Christmases, you know, a big roaring fire in the fireplace out in the middle of nowhere, snow building up on the sides of the mountains, but you were in the middle of tourist land.
I joked that I grew up out where the satellite dishes grow, you know, because nobody could get cable. But as they got tourist money, they all put out satellites, dishes. And yeah, but it's also country. It's not even country, it's mountain, which is a very different thing. People in country, they have trucks. People in the mountains walk.
Yeah. But when you were a little boy, like most kids, the holiday was very special, wasn't it?
We didn't have a chimney, so I was always like, how does he get in? I was always my concern.
This sounds like a song you could be writing at Christmas time about a little boy with no chimney in the house for Santa Claus.
See, look, you're only two steps from writing a Christmas song, Bill.
You do always write Christmas music, and I think I'm correct that quite often people are coming to you, artists are coming to you and asking you to write songs for them. It's not so much that you're recording this music as you are writing it for other artists, right?
Yeah. Christmas music is it's a fantastic passion of mine. And I do let all of my friends know, like, hey, look, if you're ever looking for a Christmas song, I feel like Diane Warren or something. Like, I don't pitch myself very much or very often. But when it comes to Christmas music, I'm telling you, if you are listening right now and you have need for Christmas music in your life, and you're like, man, I really think I am your guy.
Call Christian
Call
Bush.
Me. Now, weirdly, I do not do the tradition where I write Christmas songs in June or July, which is when you actually get asked for them. I write them in the season before. So right now, I am stacked probably four tall in this season's Christmas songs, three of which are probably terrible.
Do you want to? You brought your guitar. Are you willing to share at least a part of one of those songs with us?
I can share.
All right.
Absolutely.
I'd love to hear it.
You know, Christmas songs sit if you're a passionate Christmas music listener, the Christmas music canon in America is a very tight list. They're either super sentimental, and they kind of make you go into dreamy land, or they're super funny. Or Grandma Got Ran Over by a Reindeer, and those are the two kind of pendulum pieces of Christmas music. And so I like to live on both sides. So this is an extreme country song. And I'll just play the first little bit of it, but Christmas is a very special time of year. Any minute now, my relatives will all be here. Please, God, don't let me run out of beer. I'm thinking about drinking for Christmas, filling my glass to the top with some holiday wishes. It doesn't matter what you're sipping, it's the gift that keeps on giving. Just thinking about drinking for Christmas. Right?
I love that kind of warm, sentimental song moves me.
Well, I mean, that's just fun, you know?
Yes.
I know, you know, it's a big stretch to rhyme thinking and drinking. I just want to tell you, it's just never been done before, I'm sure.
What's the other side of a Christian Bush Christmas song when you do get warm and sentimental?
Okay, here's the other side of that. So other side, musically, you want it to be dreamy.
I already know, listening to the opening chords,
You know what this is.
This is one of the most beautiful Christmas songs I think that's ever been written. You recorded this with your partner, Jennifer Nettles.
Yeah, with Jennifer.
With Sugarland. Did you write this song?
I did.
Would you mind playing just a little of it? It's gorgeous.
Thank you. I started in a snowstorm in Chicago. Christmas trees in window panes shimmering where tinsel hangs and the butter live candlesticks shines the snowflakes off the bricks and the postman is shivering with packages he's delivering and ribbons try to hide inside the wishes waiting warm inside.
I'm going to join you on the chorus.
And everything looks better in gold and green. Yeah.
Sing it, Christian.
Lights on the tree in the eyes of my children are the prettiest I've ever seen. And the world decides to sleep safe tonight. Yeah. That's a dreamy one.
It's a beautiful song. We're going to play the version that you and Jennifer recorded together, too.
Oh, yes.
So they can hear the fully produced song. You know, you talked about White Christmas and how much money that song made. This song was a pretty big hit for you, wasn't it? Am I right about that?
Weirdly.
Part of a record that
well,
you made.
Well, I named the record after
yes.
that. You know, Christmas records are strange. Maybe you don't know this, but it doesn't satisfy any requirement for your record contract.
Really?
Christmas records are solely because you want to.
So if you have, say, a three-record deal with mm-hmm. your label, you have to, you're going to have to deliver to them three records, and then the holiday album is like
it doesn't count
an
as
extra.
One of the three.
Why?
Usually holiday records don't have original music on them. Mm. And I think, you know, the history of the music business can be found in any record contract. Because you're watching, you know, what people close loopholes that other people found. And when I found that out, I was like, wow. Because I love Christmas records. And I used to make them as gifts for my family because I didn't have enough money really to buy everybody a gift. But I did have enough money to sit down and write a song for them. And then I would duplicate the cassette or make the CD for them. And I'm sure they rolled their eyes when I would give it to them. But when I found out that we had the opportunity to do one with Sugarland, I was beside myself. And I was like, hey, by the way, I am extremely prepared for this moment.
We're going to take a break right now. But as we do, let's listen to the Sugarland recording of Christian's beautiful Christmas song, Golden Green.
The postman. Shivering with packages he's delivering, ribbons pull and try to hide wishes waiting warm inside.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is country music star Christian Bush. We invite him into the Two-Way Street studio every year at holiday time because Christian loves Christmas music. After hearing a couple of the Christmas songs that he wrote, I wanted to share with him a couple of my contemporary favorites by other artists. The first, what I thought of is, and it is obviously a Southern Christmas song, that really moved me because I was embracing my new experience in the South as a Chicagoan.
Oh, yeah.
And this song was played all the time on radio down here.
Mm-hmm.
York City. There's snow on the ground, and out in California the sunshine's falling down. And maybe down in Memphis, Graceland's all in lights. And in Atlanta, Georgia, there's peace on earth tonight. Christmas in Dixie.
Alabama, Christmas in Dixie. How do you rate that song, Christian?
I would say that's extremely high.
That's
in the canon of country music, and weirdly in the canon of Christmas music. Like, that one is like the John Denver Muppets thing. Like, it'll cross over into big culture.
So you were talking about being from Sevierville before. Here's a song. I just want to play a little of this too, because it is a Christmas song. Interestingly enough, it's from a Broadway musical, but it was Dolly Parton, your neighbor up there near Pigeon Forge, who made a big hit out of it.
Hey, maybe I'll dye my hair. Maybe I'll move somewhere. Maybe I'll get a car. Maybe I'll drive so far that I'll lose track. Me, some weight. Maybe I'll clear my junk. Maybe I'll just get drunk on apple wine. Me, I'll be just fine.
Song's from the Best Little Whorehouse,
yeah, it
in
is.
Texas.
And I didn't know that she didn't write that.
No, she didn't. You know, I'm going to have to look. I'm going to look up now who the songwriter is.
It's Carole Hall. And knowing that it's from a soundtrack, that makes sense, because a lot of times, you know, they don't sign the singer on until after the songs have been picked.
Yeah.
In soundtracks and movies.
Yeah, it started as a Broadway show, and then it was made into a movie. And Dolly mm-hmm. did play the part of the madam in the motion picture
in the
version
motion picture.
Of that. So what would, you know, as long as we're talking about Dolly Parton, growing up near where Dolly Parton came from must have been really an extraordinary experience for you.
It was the only way that I saw to get out. You know, like... If you dig far enough down into my past, into the rabbit hole of Wikipedia links, you know, you're going to find out that the town that I came from, Sevierville, it doesn't have a lot of ways out of it. I mean, you can go to Knoxville and try to get a job there and maybe go to school there or something, but there are not a lot of fast tracks out of Sevierville, and there's not a lot of reason to. Place is awesome, and it's in a valley, and you know, the boom of tourism, you know, maybe you could become a hotel magnate or something, I don't know. But for a musician, it was amazing, because Dolly Parton always reinvested in her community. Like, she bought the radio station, she bought what was essentially our amusement park, which was Silver Dollar City, or before that it was Gold Rush Junction, and she bought it and renamed it Dollywood.
So you grew up going to that amusement park before it became Dollywood.
Oh, yeah. I grew up, I was on the swim team, and the only swimming pool we had was in the parking lot of Gold Rush Junction. So, and I actually became a swimmer and swam for Emory. Like, that was how far back. But if you played music, and one of the things that you could possibly do, because it had been done by someone in your community, was you could become, maybe, if you worked hard enough, you could be a country star. But what that required of you is you had to, A, you know, be not just a great singer and a great player, but you had to write your own music because Dolly wrote all of her own songs, right? And, I mean, minus the Christmas song we just heard, but it was both a, hey, this is possible, and, hey, that's near impossible.
Yeah. You certainly at one point or another with Sugarland must have worked with Dolly Parton on the same bill with her. I got a concert bill somewhere, right?
My first and actually weirdly only co-billing with Dolly Parton was when I was a child.
Really?
My family at the time, they don't own it anymore, but they owned a cannery. And so the little town in Chestnut Hill that was surrounding it, everybody there worked for the cannery, and Granddaddy would throw a party for everybody, like a Christmas party. And it was called the Jamboree. And they would hire, you know, whoever the most famous country star they could afford at the time to come and play Jamboree. So there are pictures of, like, you know, Hank Jr. being there and all these different things. And there's this one picture of Dolly Parton, because, you know, she lived there, but she was super famous at the time, and she had come back. She usually came back to Sevierville to play the high school, but this time she came to the Jamboree, and my brother and I were both budding violinists in the Suzuki method, which is a Japanese method of playing classical music, which has zero to do with country music. But because we were the sons of the people who were putting it on, they let us get up and play, you know, two songs before everybody else. And there's this great picture of us hugging her.
Wow.
And if you can imagine what it was like to be 7 years old and the height that you are at 7 years old hugging Dolly Parton, that picture has a lot in it.
Do you still have it?
Of course I do. But I've never, you know, funny enough, during, you know, this Sugarland hiatus, Jennifer signed on to actually play in a Hallmark. Was it a Hallmark?
Yeah, it was a Hallmark picture.
Hallmark version of Dolly's life.
Yeah.
And so she and Dolly got to know each other through that. But, I mean, it's irony of ironies that I haven't really hung out or really had conversation with Dolly Parton, but Jennifer ended up playing her mother in my hometown.
Wow.
Fictional hometown, like probably on the streets that I walk around on. So, if you know, Dolly Parton is a force of creative nature.
Yeah. She really is. I think people who don't really absorb and appreciate traditional country, it's really easy for them to kind of look down on her, to make fun of her, because she certainly presents herself in a flamboyant way. But the people who really appreciate music understand that she has been an extraordinarily talented songwriter and singer for many, many years. And she's still doing it, Christian.
Still doing it. And still doing it, you know. I like to call Dolly Parton, she's one of the gateway drugs into country music. Like, you know, if you were a big Whitney Houston fan, then your favorite song is I Will Always Love You. And if you, when you go and read the liner notes, remember those things, you'll find out that Dolly Parton wrote that song by herself. And then when you start figuring that out, your brain starts to go, wait a minute, what? Yeah, that lady sat on the end of her bed somewhere and wrote that song. And Queen Whitney Houston, rest in peace, sang it.
Yeah.
And changed the world with it, right? Long after Dolly had done it. So not only she presents in a very caricature kind of way, but you got to remember at the time where she was becoming famous, women were not in control of their lives as artists, and she was, and not in control of their careers, and she was. And my favorite thing you can ever see of Dolly Parton is to watch her go on David Letterman. There are moments where she's in there, and he starts making fun of, you know, her chest or the way that she looks. And she was like, Dave, now I appreciate that, but I'm here to sell a record. And he just doesn't know how to respond to her being direct. And it reminded me that at all times, the entertainment business and the music business are different.
Oh, that's a great observation. Let's talk about your year. Can we do that?
Yeah,
for a
go ahead.
While? You lost your dad this year.
I did.
And that was especially hard. I think I'm right, because it was not an easy relationship.
Oh, no. I lost my dad. I don't know if anybody out there, I mean, if you're listening and you've lost a parent, but especially as a man losing your dad, it's a little different. I lost my mom when I was 30, and that was trauma. I mean, I still have after images and reverberations.
It happened suddenly, too.
It was on Thanksgiving, which is why, you know, Thanksgiving gets weird for me. But that was 17 years ago. Like, you would think that a heart would recover in that kind of time, but you don't forget things like that. But my father, in passing, he and I had gotten more and more estranged, which sometimes happens in families. But it was weird. He had always claimed a little bit of not just concern, but, and I wouldn't say it's as much as disdain, but disapproval of my passion for being a recording artist. And as I would succeed, he would become more excited. But I always remembered all the moments where he wasn't. But suddenly, you know, I decided one year I was going to have a change of heart, and I invited him to the CMA Awards. And he came, and this was a big turn, because he was really mad at me. And I was like, Dad, I know you and I don't see eye to eye, but would you come to this award show? It's in a big arena. I know you don't like a lot of people, but and we won that night. And I kind of got up on stage, and I thanked him for always believing in me. And I knew it was a lie. I knew I was thanking him for something that wasn't true. But I thought, you know what? You got to start somewhere, right? And what if that turns his heart? That'll change my life forever if it does. And I don't need to carry this burden around. You can even get online and see it on YouTube or something. And I thanked him, and he stood up in the arena and took like a one circle, waving at the entire crowd of 17,000 people. And I was like, wow, that's awesome.
That is such a Christian Bush thing to say. You always find a way to turn what can be a difficult situation into something positive. People who follow you on Facebook will see every single day you post some inspirational message. So it strikes me that what you just said is absolutely representative of how you think about life. You find the best in life, no matter what the circumstances.
Oh, thank you. Life is hard anyway. And then, you know, not a couple years later, it went back into darkness. And he called me and said he was very sick, and he only had 2 or 3 months to live. And he said he wanted me to come see him, and this was his past year. So I got in the car, and I drove up to see him. Every single moment that I wasn't on a stage or in a studio, I drove to see him, and we set our lives straight with each other. And it was a last great act of parenting that I saw my dad do.
What had he done for a living?
My dad inherited his father's factory, which was the Bush Brothers canning factory.
Yeah, people don't know that Christian Bush, your family is Bush Baked Beans. Your great-grandfather founded that company.
That's right. And so, and then he had the strange reality of when he was about 30, late 30s, early 40s, that the family kind of got forced into selling the business. And so he really didn't get to be, was never the president. He was never the whatever. And the money that they got from it was early 80s money. So there was a lot of booms and crashes in their savings between that.
Another big thing that happened to you this year is you produced an album for a young artist named Lindsay L., who you're very excited about.
Lindsay L. Is a guitar player and a singer and a songwriter. And she's from Nashville right now. And she, the record company that I am signed to as a solo artist, came to me and said, would you mind producing her record? And she came down here to Atlanta, which was a beautiful way to do this, is to make the music here. And she did an unbelievable thing. She made a record, her first record ever, and did such a good job that it became the number one record in the country when it was released.
We're going to play one song from that album. What song should we play?
I think you should play a song called Champagne.
Okay.
It is the riskiest song on the record. It is the highest risk, highest reward.
Don't you dare take your hand off the small of my back. When we walk into a crowd, I love it when you do that. Keep telling me I'm beautiful, even though this room is full of VIPs, like that crystal chandelier. ain't got nothing on me. You make me feel like Jessica Biel, stepping out of a stretch, diamonds hugging my neck. For the paparazzi got me like I'm dropping the mic. So naturally, David, just call me Aretha. For real, you make me feel like I'm the champagne.
I want to go back to your dad because it also brings us to another big event for you this year. We were never really able to talk about this on Two Way Street because we didn't want to get into a conflict of interest. But you and my wife, Janice Schaefer,
yes,
wrote a musical together.
We did.
Called Troubadour. And one of the things, I want to ask you about that experience in general, but in terms of your dad, the heart of that show is about the biggest star, an older country music star, who is about to retire. He has had a very uneasy relationship with his grown son. And a great deal of the show is about their inability to communicate and the question of whether they'll find a way to reconcile. That must have really resonated with you as you watched that show and worked on that show.
I was trying not to go too far in because it was very, very close to the surface. But at the same time, I felt very prepared to be honestly dealing with that, not necessarily out loud. Like, I don't think I even talked to my kids about that reality. And I'm not sure I even discovered that that was truly happening until I think maybe Rolling Stone interviewed me about, hey, is this really happening? And I was in the middle of like prepping dad's funeral when they called. So I was like, oh yeah. And I also wrote this musical about a father and a son. Holy crap. So your wife, Janice, the story was already there. The story was already, I was just hanging ornaments off the tree, you know, is really what I was doing to try to show you which things to look at, right? But the way music works for me is that these things that happen in your life end up in your songs no matter what. And the stories in a musical, I was telling myself that all I was supposed to do was put their stories into songs. The problem is that now that the thing has happened and I go and play the songs, I realize I put my story in her story. And I sometimes feel like a voyeur, like I'm doing something wrong, like I'm letting down the characters.
You had a great challenge in that show. You were asked, well, you tell me, you weren't asked to write. Janice didn't have a show about contemporary Nashville. She wrote about Nashville in the early 1950s and about country music stars who had been on the scene in the 30s. And so what was your challenge to, in terms of the scope of the work you had to write?
Well, it was impossible.
From what year? I mean, you had to start.
I had to back it up. So all I did is I used my own life. I said, okay, Sugarland started when essentially my ex-wife was pregnant with my first child, which was 2002 is when he was born. And we wrote those songs that year and the next year, but they didn't get on the radio for another 3 years. And now I am, what are we, 15 years later? Because Tucker's 15. And those songs that we wrote then are still our most played songs, right? So I had to use that as a reference to say, if someone is retiring in 1951 by forcefully being retired, that 20 years earlier, they had to have written that song. So I had to figure out what their version of My Baby Girl was.
Yeah, what would a song that a country artist...
What would it have been? And so I had to go listen to a bunch of 1930s music, 40s, 50s, 60s, and then think about how I wrote Baby Girl. What was I listening to? I was listening to Dixie Chicks. I was listening to Steve Earle. I was listening to current contemporary country music. And then I had to imagine, what would these characters be listening to at the time? You know, who would they want to be imitating in order to succeed? And then I had to become them. So that was my challenge. I mean, thank goodness that I didn't have to go look at like microfiche. You know, thank goodness the internet existed.
Is there any song from that show you'd be willing to share with us? Or at least
Sure.
What, is there a favorite? I mean, there was, by the way, being incredibly modest, you were an equal partner in making that show what it was, and it was as much about you as it was about Janice. So.
Well, I'll tell you what, I partner for a living. That's what I do, and Janice has been, I would say, if not the most successful partnership creatively I've had. I wrote this one. This is one of my favorite ones, and it's not very super prominent. It's used in a different way. I think it's used as a weapon. Actually, okay. This song is called "White White Steeple in a Blue Blue Sky," and it was a title that she had Janice had thrown out, like, "Oh, you know, something like this." And I was like, "What do you mean like that? That is awesome. I already know what that song sounds like." She's like, "Really?" And I'm like, "Yeah. You said it out loud, and it all just is in my head, like as if God has now thrown this stuff in my brain." And she said, "Really?" And then as we started to develop it. I said, you know, songs are used in many different ways, and this the father forces the son to sing this song for him. It's like, sing it the way I sing it. And it's a very uncomfortable part of the story, but the song's origination is really supposed to be what would have been on the radio and would have been a hit at the end of the 30s, early 40s. So this is 1939, early 1940, which is when sacred and secular music were almost, as country music, inseparable. So it's not gospel, it's still folk music, but it's considered country. He lifted me just like a cross, so I would not be wandering lost, so I could always see. Raised it high, was a white, white steeple in a blue, blue sky. Hey, that white, white steeple in a blue, blue sky. Singing hallelujah in the by and by. You can keep on walking, walking till you find that white, white steeple in a blue, blue sky.
Wow. Great song.
Right?
Yeah.
And it feels like it existed then.
Yeah, it does. It really feels like it could have been on the Opry.
On the Opry. That was the whole idea. I mean, those were part of the requirements, which, you know, like, at least she could have helped me a little. But, you know, all these songs had to be the hits of the time, not the B-sides. So I couldn't really have any throwaways, you know?
I always talk about this. You've just been, on December 9th, you played the Ryman Auditorium.
I love that.
Well, there's not a musical guest who comes in here who plays the Ryman, who I don't have to ask about that. I mean, I have to. I grew up in Skokie, Illinois, in a Jewish neighborhood, but on Saturday nights, for some reason, we started listening to WSM on that Clear Channel station, listening to the Opry. Chris Thiele was here. We talked about what it's like to play the Ryman. Jimmy Webb talked about playing. Bill Anderson has been here. We talked about it. What's it like to play the Ryman, Christian Bush, the mother church of country music?
It's surreal, first of all, but it also never stops being surreal. I mean, I made a commitment when I started my solo career that I was afraid people weren't going to believe me. Much like when I started a country band, I didn't think they would believe me. So I decided to wear a cowboy hat, which I bought off of eBay. But with the Ryman and the Opry, you know, I made a commitment to play there every month if they would let me. I'm not an Opry member. I have not been asked to join, none of that. But I decided that was where the real conversation of country music's happening. And as I started to play more and more often, I realized that the songs that, because you get to pick two songs on weekends, three songs on the weekdays. Because on the weekdays, there's no host. Mm-hmm. But on the weekends, there are. And so you pick two songs, and you send it to the band ahead of time, and you walk out on stage with no rehearsal, and you play. And I started to send them songs I'd written that week, rather than songs that were hits. Because I thought to myself, what happens if people like it? You're going to know immediately, you know, how this goes. So playing at the Ryman has turned into not just a reverent experience for me. It's also my laboratory.
I saw you play the Ryman a night that Bill Anderson was hosting your half hour of the show. And You know, Bill is a legend in all of country music, but he's especially close to the people of Georgia. He grew up in Decatur, went to Avondale High School, had his own little show as a high school kid on WSB radio when he had a little high school band. And Bill told me that when he did our show that he did some writing with you and Jennifer at one point. You wrote at least one or two songs together, I
Absolutely.
Think.
Absolutely. You know, at some point I had run into Bill, and he is one of the active legends of the city and of the community, and he's not shy about it. He'll actually come up to you and talk about it, and he feels as viable as a songwriter right now as he does anything else. And he said, "We really need to write a song." I said, "Yeah, we do. Oh my gosh, you're Bill Anderson."
What'd you write?
We wrote a song called Joey.
How'd which
was
go?
It was great. It was incredible. And did he tell you about the song?
No, but you're sitting there with a guitar.
Joey, I'm so sorry. It was a Joey, I'm so sorry. It was awesome because we wanted to write a song. We had brought this idea to him, and he came to our hotel room because we didn't have any place to stay in Nashville. And we said, "Here's what we want to do. There's this woman who's apologizing to her dead boyfriend." And Bill's like, "Oh, I love it." And I was like, "Well, you know, let's start." And I think it's a car crash. I'm not sure what happened, but in my mind, I think that's where that is. And it's this regret, like unrequited love song, because I needed something that yearned. And he said, "Okay." And then he said, we started to write, and he said, "Well, why don't we write it backwards?" And I looked at him kind of funny, like, "I don't know, man. How old are you now? You're in your 70s. Like, are you just saying that? Or is this really a good skill to learn? Let's entertain it for a minute." Jennifer's looking at me with big eyes, and I'm looking back at her, like, because you're in the moment. And I was like, "Okay, well, show me what you mean." He's like, "Well, let's kill him in the first sentence, you know?" And I was like, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, "Well, you know, all the good stuff happens after somebody dies." And I was like, "Oh." And so we killed the guy in the first thing, and then what you see is this woman's regret over it, and it became such an emotionally, like, thick story. And I will never forget the kind of that lesson from Bill Anderson of, look, man, and it's not what happens when the thing happens, it's what happens the day after.
Who recorded that song first? Did he or did
we
you?
Did. You no, did. We did. It's on a record called Love on the Inside.
Okay.
And I think it is literally, I think I put it as track 3 or track 4. Like, it lived in a certain space for me.
What if I said yes? What if I'd gone out that night? What if you turned left? Everything would have turned out all right. What if I spoke up? What if I took the keys? What if I
We only have a few minutes left. How long has it been since you and Jennifer Nettle stopped recording or performing in Sugarland?
We stopped right when her baby was born. So that was at the end of 2012. We went on hiatus.
You were at that point the biggest act in country music by most accounts. And you decided to go into a hiatus. Your fans were devastated, and I imagine there hasn't been a day that's gone by since then that you haven't heard from friends, fans, people who really want to know if you're ever getting back together again, right? Isn't that true?
That is very true.
Does that feel okay, by the way, that you and Jennifer individually, you've done fine, but that everybody says, "Okay, great, that's Christian, that's Jennifer, but what about the two of you?"
Well, I love that people are such big fans that they ask.
You and Jennifer are back together. You did have a reunion on the CMA show a couple weeks back, which blew people away.
Yes, they invited us to come to the CMA Awards and present an award that we won for a very long time.
Wow, funny seeing you here.
Feels like we've been here before. Right?
You know, that's true. In fact, we're here to present the CMA Award we won together in 2007, 2008, 2009, 2010, 2011, and well, who knows?
And that was a lot of fun. A number of days later, we got to reveal that maybe before that we had been writing music and in a studio. And it's the kind of thing where we're discovering it at the same time you are. So I would say go on the ride with us. We're not quite sure because, you know, what's cool about this band and has always been cool about this band is it's about what happens when the two of us mix. And we're making music. I would say that it feels fantastic.
That's exciting. Well, it's a phenomenal way to end what was already been an exciting and in some ways a difficult year for you. So we'll look forward to seeing what happens with Sugarland. We brought you in here saying it's Christmas time and you're Mr. Christmas. Can you play us out with, whether it's one of your compositions or one of your favorite traditional songs, will you play us out with some Christmas music?
I'll play you some Christmas music. Hang on. Those are the most complicated, expensive chords I know right here. Well, the weather outside is frightful. The fire is so delightful. If you know a place to go, let it snow, let it snow, let it snow.
Thank you, Bill, for having me very much.
Christian, thank you for keeping alive an annual Christmas time tradition. Christian Bush in our studios here in Atlanta.
Let it snow, let it snow, let it snow. There you go.
There's a lot of exciting news around the Sugarland reunion. Jennifer and Christian will be releasing a single called Still the Same in the week before Christmas. Then they'll appear together on ABC's New Year's Rockin' Eve. And they've already said they'll be touring in 2018, although the details of that Sugarland tour are yet to be released. I couldn't be happier for our friend Christian Bush that he has such great news for 2018. That's it for today's show. Our senior producer is Jenny Amond. Our associate producer is Olivia Rheingold. Olivia and Jenny worked together on editing this week's show. Our engineer is Tyler Morris. I'm Bill Nygut. Thanks for listening. I hope to see you again next week for another holiday edition of Two-Way Street.